Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What gets passed down from each generation to the next, and how much influence do those objects, ideas, and attributes have on who we are in the present? For most of human existence, we relied on stories and artifacts to connect us to the past. Today, science offers perspective on the genetic legacies of our forebears as well. And my guest believes that by combining all of those sources of information about the past, we can examine our shared past with greater clarity than ever before. The new book by journalist Christine Keneally is called The Invisible History of the Human Race, How DNA and History Shape Our Identities and Our Futures. Chris, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much, Chris. Thanks for having me.
What got you interested in what we could learn by overlaying genomic information with history?
Yeah, I guess I'd always had a professional interest in it as a journalist who writes a lot about science. And I sort of started this process after finishing my last book, which was about evolutionary history. But there were personal reasons as well. You know, I felt very strongly about these issues, and I realized perhaps a year into this process that partly it was because of information that had not been passed down in my family years and years ago. I guess when I was a child, I went through an experience that many people do. You know, I was in, I think it was about second grade. I was 8 years old, and the teacher told us what a family tree was. And this happens to everyone, right? And you learn what a family tree is. You take it home and you talk to your parents and you say, well, what were my grandparents' names? What were my great-grandparents' names? And I was very excited about the project. But when I went home, I was startled by my parents' reaction. They were quite indignant about it. And you know, we just did a sort of quick job and we smoothed it over. But that stayed with me for a long time. And many years later, when I was in my early 20s, I was called home. I sat down with my parents. All my siblings were there as well, my four siblings. And my father then shared with us that the man that we had thought was his grandfather was actually his grandfather. So there had been this family secret. And it became clear to me from that point on that, you know, that had shaped a significant amount of his life, and it had shaped our life as well.
What's fascinating about it is that you and your siblings, you know, I suppose it was unfortunate that things didn't happen the way they do in the typical manner, but you didn't find it so scandalous. For your father, though, on top of everything else, there was this great shame that he had carried with him for an act that really didn't have any, you know, he didn't do anything wrong.
That's absolutely right. He is an innocent, and yet for many people who experienced a similar kind of story in the 1930s, growing up in a strongly Catholic community, it was this incredibly powerful event, and it really had shaped his life, and it shaped our relationship with him to some extent, because this was something that he carried but he felt like he couldn't share. And certainly my siblings and I, you know, even though our conservative Catholic parents had raised us, you know, we did not have that response at all. But it was a very shocking thing to discover. If you had asked me 5 minutes before that conversation took place if there was a secret in my family, I would have said absolutely not.
You write about something, a concept called path dependency. Can you explain what that is and how that plays into this exploration?
Sure. Well, I mean, economists talk about path dependency. Scientists talk about path dependency. One of the simplest example of path dependence is evolution. You know, we've been evolving as a species for many hundreds of thousands of years, and every stage we get to is dependent on the step we were at just beforehand. We evolve out of whatever has come before us. And I think this is a really fascinating concept for us to think about our lives and the ways that our lives are shaped, not just by our personal past, but by our family's past and our lineage's past. You know, whether it's a sort of cultural influence or a genetic influence, every step informs the next step that happens.
So now that we know what genes are, and now that we're beginning to understand how they shape us physiologically, we've arrived at this moment where we have to figure out what to do with that information. Why is that such a vexing question?
It is very vexing. I think we've been afraid of genes and afraid of DNA for a long time. You know, on the one hand, science has been driving all this forward, but But I think there's fear for a number of reasons. I think people are worried about what they'll discover in their DNA, whether it's something to do with one of their possible futures, something to do with their health or a trait. And they're also worried about uncovering things that happened in the past. And then, of course, there's this question of, like, how much genes influence us and how much our society or our physical environment influences us. I think for a long time, people have pushed back against the idea that we're really shaped by our genes, that we can be shaped by our genes, because it's not equitable. You know, there's no equality in that. You get dealt that hand when you're born, and not everyone gets dealt the same hand. And so particularly in America, in Australia, in, you know, modern Western democracies, we don't like the idea that people come into the world with different equipment, different tools, different potentials.
And yet it does seem that in countries like the US and Australia and Canada, countries of immigrants, we have a greater need maybe than other people whose families have lived in the same place for 1,000 years to understand what has come before us and who has come before us.
It's funny. I think we do and we don't. I think there is an impulse towards that knowledge and an impulse against it. And I think in America, you can trace it back to the Revolutionary War, when prior to the war, people were quite into their genealogies. And it was about a way of connecting with the old world, of establishing their status in the new world where nothing was really familiar or known. But then when the war occurred, it was about people wanted to throw that off, and they wanted to feel like they could have an identity that didn't have to be explained by what had come before them. So at that time, genealogy was actually, that was when genealogy began to be quite unpopular. And since then, we've had these sort of two impulses running through society. One, on the one hand, we do care about where we come from, and it isn't clear to us, particularly those of us in the new world. But on the other hand, we're afraid that people are, you know, going to condemn us for what came before us or limit our options. And you know, the psychology of America in particular is a psychology of opportunity and ambition and this idea that anyone can be whoever they want to be.
In this country, many people have been devastated, of course, to discover that they are descended from slaveholders. On the other hand, there are other people who are, devastated to discover that their ancestors were slaves, and the reasons for being upset are very different there. But what are we supposed to do with family history that would seem to reveal some sordid characteristic that we do not want to find in ourselves?
Well, personally, if people don't want to explore that, I don't think they should feel pressured to do that. You know, we've got to respect people's sensitivities around that. But for the rest of us, you know, I think we need to embrace it. I think we need to dig into it. Many people are descended from both slaveholders and from slaves. Mm. And if we actually step forward and look at it, we'll discover the commonalities amongst people and the fact that everyone has complexity in their genome. No one has a blameless genome. No one has a perfect genome. Everyone has things that are good, things that are bad, history that is complicated, and history that perhaps looks a little cleaner.
I loved reading in your book about the history, just a little bit of the history of Van Diemen's Land, which of course is now called Tasmania. Remarkably, was started as a penal colony by the British Empire, did not turn out to be a place plagued by crime to any greater extent than anywhere else.
Yeah, the Tasmanian story was really fun. I was excited to discover during my research that I had descended from a convict. I always wanted to have descended from a convict, but I was told quite firmly by my father at a young age that that hadn't happened. And in fact, he hadn't known because the secret had been kept so well. But even better, I went and spoke to an Australian historian or a Tasmanian specialist. Her name is Alison Alexander. She went through a very similar thing. She was told by her very offended grandmother that there were absolutely no convicts in the family tree. And after a little digging, she discovered there were 9 convicts in the family tree. So she took her personal history and used it to sort of dig further into the Tasmanian history. And what's so remarkable about Tasmania is that you know, it was founded by convicts. There were sort of much fewer of the guards and the people who were in control, and, you know, the population was vastly one who had been shipped there, not at will, for committing some crime back in the old country. So, you know, this was the case in Tasmania for a couple of generations, but then once transportation had stopped, people wanted to distance themselves from that past. They wanted to believe that their future, you know, could be sort of clear of the past. So one of the greatest, I think, lies perpetrated in the history of the world then occurred, which was that sort of in the course of the 19th century, one generation who well knew that they were either convicts or that they were the children of convicts basically told their children that they were not, that all the convicts had gone, that they'd left or that they'd died. And no, we were the settlers who came after that. So for at least 100 years, everyone in Tasmania who were, you know, overwhelmingly descended from convicts believed that actually all the convicts had left, and they were not that case at all. So one of the most interesting consequences of this, I think, in this very tender time when people were trying to pretend that actually they were not the convicts, someone else was, the crime rate dropped incredibly. And I think there were no homicides reported in Tasmania for at least 30 years. Sort of after that time, you know, everyone relaxed a little bit and they started committing crime again, but certainly to no greater extent than anywhere else.
It's interesting because that whole idea of really trying to distance oneself from that, you know, legacy in the family tree, it speaks to a belief that there must be something inherently wrong with people who commit crimes, as opposed to people who, you know, based on circumstance or on the sort of mores of the time, have been led into illegal activity.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the Tasmanian story is the most perfect case study of that. I mean, in the Victorian era, and, you know, we still carry these ideas inside us. We're still influenced by this notion that somehow this stuff is passed on in the genes. And, you know, certainly there are conditions that are passed on in the genes. I'm not saying that's not the case, but criminality per se is absolutely not. And Tasmania is such a perfect example of that because it was essentially founded by convicts. You couldn't ask for a better experiment. You know, send a bunch of criminals to an island, get them to partner up and breed a couple of generations and see what you get. And, you know, what you get is first a very well-behaved population and then a pretty normal one.
It's strange the way over time we change how we feel about these things, and we no longer, for the most part, view them in the same way. I've thought about, you know, old West criminals, people like Jesse James and John Wesley Hardin, who were terrible individuals in the United States, but now people think of them as being sort of part of this colorful past as opposed to being, you know, scary, yeah, violent serial killers.
Yes. Yes. I mean, I guess we do that to a lot of criminals from the past. It's hard to hang on to that sense that people, I don't know, that sense of badness. You know, Genghis Khan, of course, is a well-known figure worldwide, but in Mongolia, I guess in the 1920s, the then communist government outlawed surnames. This was this very sort of disempowering thing to do to the population. But in the late 20th century, the new government brought them back in. And at the time, you know, a lot of people had become so distant from what their original surname was. They had obeyed so well that they'd lost that information. And there was this fear that everyone would take on Genghis Khan's name because, you know, the power remained. I mean, he was such a terrible, terrible character. He killed so many people, but it was perhaps the sense of power and his historical place that people wanted to copy.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Christine Kenealy. Her new book is called The Invisible History of the Human Race, How DNA and History Shape Our Identities and Our Futures. Welcome back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join us by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Bunding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Christine Keneally, whose new book is called The Invisible History of the Human Race, How DNA and History Shape Our Identities and Our Futures. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Chris, I confess I have always been baffled by the stubborn persistence of anti-Semitism in the world, and particularly within certain cultures. I did not realize until reading your book that European Jews had somehow been blamed, surely without merit, but this is before science, for spreading the plague in the 14th century. Why did the distrust of them last so much longer than the threat itself?
Yeah, it's extraordinary, isn't it? This experiment came out of some really fascinating new work in economics, where this sort of young group of economists are looking at the ways in which history gets passed down, the ways in which history matters. And what they looked at was absolutely this terrible consequence of the plague sweeping through Europe, where the villages, local villages, would sort of turn on their local Jewish population and blame them. You're absolutely right. It was before science. No one understood what was going on. I mean, you can imagine the terror. In fact, it's extremely timely with Ebola right now, where a horrible disease sweeps through. It's incredibly contagious, and many people die. This had happened, of course, before to Jews for different reasons. So in a sense, they were the minority that everyone blamed. So many villages turned on their local population. They either drove them out of town, they attacked them, and worse, they killed them. This happened all over Europe, and you know, the consequences of that for the Jewish population were enormous. But you're absolutely right. The anti-Semitism continued. And one of the ways these economists have showed that it wasn't just general anti-Semitism, it was an anti-Semitism that was passed down in these particular regions and potentially by these particular families, because they looked at the same kind of thing that went on in pre-World War II Germany. So at that time, the Nazi Party were in power, but the war hadn't started. They compared villages back in medieval Europe that had attacked their Jewish populations, and they also looked at villages in 20th century Europe that also did the same thing to their Jewish populations just before World War II. They turned upon the local Jews, they destroyed their property, they physically assaulted them. And they found that there was actually a connection there, that the villages that had done it, committed this kind of crime back in medieval times, they were actually significantly more likely to have done the same thing again. Mm. So you know, their idea is that this does get passed down, you know, in these small populations within the families.
And I suppose, not for a moment to justify this, but what we fear and loathe, those are the things we're most careful to tell our children about, right? We might pass on a love of music. We might want to make sure that they, you know, appreciate art or good cooking. But the things we're afraid of are the things that we definitely say, make sure you know this.
Yes, I don't know that anyone out there has started looking at the transmission of, you know, of positive attitudes. I mean, it has to happen. I'm sure it has to happen, or at least the absence of these horrendously negative ideas and the kind of consequences that they have. But certainly this idea that is that the transmission of hatred is actually very effective, very strong through hundreds and hundreds of years.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Judy in Dallas. Hello, Judy.
Hi, Judy.
Yes, Chris, thank you. I have a comment about when you check your genealogy and all this, why do the Mormons have all that information? How did they get it and why? What's the reasoning behind it? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Okay, sure. Thank you for your question. The LDS Church plays an incredibly significant role in modern day genealogy. They are so interesting, and I went and visited them a number of times during the course of the book. They, the LDS Church, believe, based on the doctrine of their founder Joseph Smith, that that it is important to offer ancestors an opportunity to be baptized into the church. So anyone who's been born after Joseph Smith, of course, is able to look up his doctrines and, you know, has an opportunity to join the church. But people who died beforehand don't get that opportunity. So there is a belief in the church that church members should look up their past family as far back as they can possibly go, and then they formally offer baptism into the LDS Church for those people. So that's the idea. But the impact that this has had on the activity of the church is just so interesting, because the LDS Church is like many other churches in that they try to do good works in the world. They care about charity and these sort of very familiar religious activities. But one of their very unique activities is that they are really they think really hard about, and they're extremely adept at information storage, because they've had for about 100 years now, they have been seeking out the names and details of pretty much everyone in the world in order to bring them together in a database so that people can more easily find their distant relatives. This has had so many consequences. They, you know, they were leaders in microfilm storage, and then they're very interested in digital storage right now. They built an archive inside a mountain in Utah. It's called the Granite Mountain Vault, where they store all this information. So if some kind of catastrophe occurs outside, this incredible database that's been built over almost 100 years now will survive.
It's interesting that for some people the names are enough, and for other people what they really crave is stories. But your book got me thinking a lot about the fact that in many cultures we are encouraged to be proud of our ancestry. And it's at least worth asking, what do they have to do with us if we've never met them, and why are we so eager to claim them?
Yeah. You know, I'm not sure if we should be proud of our ancestry. I think that's a really normal human emotion, and I certainly don't object to the idea that people might be proud of their ancestry. It's fun to discover those people that you didn't know about before. I really enjoyed learning about my convicts, but you know, I've enjoyed learning about the writers in the family too. So I'm not suggesting that we should be proud, but perhaps that we shouldn't judge people if we are proud. But I think that these incredible experiments about what gets passed down genetically, these experiments about what get passed down emotionally, the ways in which our ideas and our attitudes might be shaped, actually sort of point us in the direction of some pretty sensible questions about our ancestors. If we come from a people who migrated very recently, I think that we want to ask some questions about how that might shape who we are, how the attitudes of the old world, whatever our family's old world is, might have been passed down by the individuals in it. If we come from a family that has been very static for a very long time too, I think that we have some really interesting questions to ask about why that is the case.
We do, of course, have to be careful about, now that we are learning to understand it, the function of at least some genes and how they might affect us physiologically, how can we find a way to be comfortable with amending what we can fix in order to make people's lives healthier and better? How do we ensure that we don't sort of fall into anything resembling the kind of disastrous belief in eugenics that helped justify things like Nazi ideology in the 20th century?
Yes, those were terrible days for science and for history altogether. But I think what was happening at that time was that, you know, ideas that were really entrenched in society already were transferred into our scientific endeavors. So, you know, social class was accepted. The idea that some people simply were better than other people. The idea that some populations or ethnic groups were better or were more skilled in certain ways than others. So I'm personally not afraid of a new 21st century eugenics at all. But I think I'm super excited about the ways in which we're going to be able to address issues that arise because of our genetics. I think with genome-wide association studies where scientists are now looking at almost a million places across an individual's genome, but then doing that over a million times or hundreds of thousands of times, they're finding associations between diseases or disorders that would not have been findable any other way. So the very fact that we're starting to acquaint ourselves with our genome is allowing us to discover ways, you know, to sort of treat and cure problems that come up.
We have an email here from Joey in Denton who writes, I'm an atheist now, but grew up in a Southern Baptist family with strong ties to the church. From my early 20s until now, I've been fascinated that if I were born a world away, I could have lived my whole life without knowing the stories and convictions I was brought up to believe. It's almost scary how deeply these beliefs can run, even though they seem to be regionally tied to our birthplaces.
Yes, that's really interesting, Joey. And I think very similar thoughts like that myself when you think about, you know, when you reflect upon the ways in which different ideas get passed down and then you think about the fact that, you know, if you simply weren't there in the first place, you wouldn't have been shaped in that way. It does make you realize that, you know, you could be many different things, that you could have been shaped in many different ways. And I think that, to me, the most valuable thing about looking back at history, whether it's genetic history or cultural history, is when you sort of expose these influences upon your life, you're much more free to make up your mind about who you want to be and what you want to think.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Ken in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. I've got a question for you. Looking at the arc of history and human nature, particularly the way that Machiavelli perceived it, is it better to be infamous than anonymous?
There's a question for a Monday afternoon.
Yeah, you know, I think that's probably a very personal question. I think we'd all answer it a little bit differently. I don't know. I like anonymity. I guess it depends what you're infamous for. I mean, Genghis Khan, he's looking pretty rehabilitated these days. But, you know, if you start reading a little bit about him, you may not feel the same way.
You are adamant that people have a right to their own genomic information if they want it. And governments, at least in the United States, are starting to limit this. And there have been private companies that have offered services, and now they're not doing quite the same thing. Can you talk about why you think it's important for people to at least have access to their own information should they choose to look for it?
Yeah. I do think it's very important, and I do think that that there is much to be gained from doing that if people want to do it. And I mean, one of the most important reasons for me is just that I think to be an educated person in the 21st century, we need to know what our genome is. I mean, we've all grown up in this wonderful democracy, meaning that we've had access to basic math, basic geography. We all understand basic biology. We get anatomy, and this shapes our lives. But I think in the genome era, I mean, these are pioneering early days, but in the genome era, I think we all need to understand how we're put together, essentially, genetically. And I think that's simply a matter of education. And because the genome is such an important way of looking both at the past, it's a way of understanding history, but also individually more so, you know, it's really important for our futures. So, you know, the kinds of information that you can get right now, and this is an incredibly hot area. This is changing all the time. We're going to know so much more in just a year or even 2 years, but there's still some interesting information to be gained from, for example, you know, your health information, if you're able to have access to that. I mean, we know now about genetics of disorders that can be affected by lifestyle. You might find out that you are prone to type 2 diabetes, in which case, you know, there are some pretty clear paths you can take to help ward that off. You might find that you are more responsive to some drugs than others. That's something that I discovered. I apparently am more sensitive to a drug called warfarin, which is a blood thinner, and it's often given to people in situations like stroke. or something like that. So, you know, if I was given an average amount of warfarin, that might actually be a bit too much for me. So I think that's really interesting for me to have and for my medical doctors to have. But there are also disorders that, you know, that are perhaps not shaped by lifestyle, but whose course can be affected with prior knowledge. So one of my husband's results was that he discovered that he's got quite a high likelihood of developing prostate cancer. Now, we know this to be true because this has also happened in his family. Men in a previous generation, a number of them also developed prostate cancer. And it just happens to be my husband's personality that he paid a lot more attention to getting this information as a genetic predisposition than as part of his family history. What's so interesting to me, you know, I think he got this information about a year ago now, and it's had this small but I think potentially quite powerful impact on his life. And it's just simply this. If he sees an article in the newspaper now about prostate cancer, he will read it instead of turning the page. When we were sort of looking at our results together some time ago, there was just coincidentally a radio show on prostate cancer. Instead of turning the dial off, which I think we would have done beforehand, we listened. So slowly but surely, and in a pretty effortless way now, he is equipping himself for decisions that he may have to make further down the track.
It seems so paternalistic that anybody would say that you shouldn't have this because you might freak out with the knowledge that, say, you had a proclivity toward prostate cancer or your husband did.
Yeah, it does. It does. And it bothers me. And I think it comes from, you know, a sort of an historical attitude in the medical community where we listened to everything our doctors said and our doctors were the sole purveyors of medical information. Now, that's not to say that I think that all genetic information should be freely available. For example, you know, there are diseases like Huntington's disease, which are extremely significant, which currently, as we're searching for a cure, are fatal, and which bring with them some pretty terrible consequences. So, you know, I don't think that should be out there, or you should be able to sort of get that in your test results from 23andMe or something like that. And certainly no company, not 23andMe or anyone else, does offer that information. But there's a massive spectrum of health information and trait information out there that, you know, you can start to look at and acquaint yourself with.
My guest is journalist Christine Keneally. Her new book is called The Invisible History of the Human Race, How DNA and History Shape Our Identities and Our Futures. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, email think at kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education with courses in art, culture, history, communication, photography, and film studies. Registration online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Christine Keneally. Her new book is called The Invisible History of the Human Race, How DNA and History Shape Our Identities and Our Futures. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think at kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have John on the line in Dallas. Hi, John.
Hi. Hey, John. I was just curious whether your guest's work has any implications for people who were adopted being able to locate their birth parents.
Yes, absolutely it does. It's these are very interesting times for people who are trying to do that, for whether they have been adopted or for whatever reason. One of the most interesting ways to do that now is to submit, you know, to get your DNA read by one of these companies. There are many companies out there. I reported on the biggest ones. I went to 23andMe. I went to Ancestry or AncestryDNA.com, which is the DNA part of the very familiar Ancestry.com, and also one of the first companies in this space, Family Tree DNA. So one of the consequences of people sending in their DNA to have it read is that these companies over time have been building these massive databases of people's genomes. And one of the services they offer is that they, I guess they connect those genomes up together. They look and see what people have in common with each other, and they're able to determine if someone in the database, often someone who's never met another person, is their third or fourth or fifth cousin. So this is really fun for people for genealogy because they can communicate, they'll get together, and they'll work out what ancestor or ancestors they have in common and why it is the case that they actually have a little bit of their genome that is alike. But it's also become the case that people are starting to use, because these databases are so big, people are starting to use these databases to find birth parents. There are some people that I interviewed for the book. They are genetic genealogists, but they've also been pioneering this new kind of profession. They're genetic detectives. And when you get these people to assist you, you know, if you send your, if you get your DNA read by these three companies, you have a database of I think it's well more than a million genomes now to check your genome against. So these genetic genealogists, these detectives, they look at the relationships that you find. They might be quite distant. They might be just fourth and fifth cousins. But because they're so adept at working out genealogical history, they'll find a fourth cousin or a third cousin, and based on what information they have about where you're from, and often it's a very small amount of information, they'll work their way back up a family tree, and then they'll try to work their way down again to you. I spoke to one woman who's found many families, sometimes just the larger family groups, sometimes actual birth parents. She's been contacted by people who were babies left in dumpsters, and they've grown up with no information at all, and she's been able to help them find out what larger group they come from, if not their specific family.
It is remarkable how important it is to people who have been adopted to at least have that information. And, of course, I'm generalizing here. There
Yes.
may be people who don't want to know. But
Sure.
The other thing is, you know, many people have that experience of meeting someone ultimately who is a blood relative, realizing they look the same, they have, you know, similar medical records. And then the question is, do they have much in common socially or culturally because they haven't spent all those years together?
Yes. Yeah, and I think those stories go either way, depending on whether people have been brought up in similar ways. There are incredible stories out there of, you know, first and foremost of when people reconnect with family members like that, of just something that has been missing for so long, a hole in them is filled. And you know, and I think that's partly just about the knowledge. And if they have been denied this information, then it's even more important. One of the most shocking things that I learned while reporting this book was that in a number of states in the U.S., adoptees aren't allowed to access basic information about their parents. In some cases, they have to jump through certain hoops. You know, they have to go through counseling. And sometimes it's quite onerous counseling. But in some cases, if their birth parents have earlier sort of ticked a box or whatever it is and said, you know, we don't want them to know, then they can't find out. And I just think this was really shocking to me. This is basic information. Every human being should be able to find this out if they want to. And then beyond that, you know, when they do follow it, yes, you get these incredible stories of connection, but you get disconnect as well. And perhaps for some people, it's enough to just find out who those people were, and that's all they need.
How does a fundamental belief in the path dependency of human behavior affect your understanding of free will?
Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, this is another reason why I think people are a bit scared of genealogy and a bit scared of genetics. They're worried that someone's going to tell them that you actually don't have much free will at all. And I don't think that is the case at all. I think I don't know how to measure it. I think we have all a significant helping of free will. But I do think we can best exercise that free will if we educate ourselves about the paths, you know, that we've gone down, the paths our family has gone down. There's a lot of research out there in a similar sort of vein to the transmission of hatred from medieval times to pre-Nazi Germany about the ways in which people are influenced by the past. One of the most interesting studies to me was I think it was in the 1970s in the US, they looked at the number of children women had, and they found that there was a correlation between immigrant, second-generation women, and the number of their children and the number of children that their grandparents had back in the old country. In many cases, these women, you know, they'd never met their grandparents. They'd never been to the old country. But they had slightly more children than the women whose parents and grandparents had been in the States for longer. So that had obviously, you know, those ideas had been passed down. And this is such a personal decision, you know, this decision of how many children you're going to have. It has incredible consequences for your life and the lives of all your children. So, you know, I think we all think that that is entirely a matter of free will. A question that is that personal, and this study shows that that's not necessarily the case. So, you know, if you want to have more free will, I think you want to understand your past dependence.
There are also questions about whether our genetic makeup causes us to be part of or separate from a particular community. In this country, of course, there have been Native American tribes that have tried to prove that people have a blood connection as opposed to having been adopted into the tribe for some reason. I don't know if that's the case for Aboriginal cultures in Australia. But there are, you know, interesting things to be asked about what makes you part of a group.
That's right. And different groups have absolutely answered it differently. It's really complicated in countries like the States and Australia, where an Indigenous population has been, you know, essentially robbed of their lands and in many cases their culture as well. And you can certainly understand why these questions of blood ties might take on enormous significance. And in fact, in the United States, these are not necessarily just symbolic questions or emotional questions. They can impact someone's access to money, whether they are able to get university funds. So, you know, so from the outside, I think people can be quite skeptical sometimes about these ways of defining group membership. And from the inside, you know, people who have been fighting for justice on many fronts want to make sure that, you know, that others aren't coming in and availing themselves of certain privileges. So it's extremely fraught. And even today, lots of groups, it fascinates me, define it very differently. For some, it's just about biology and blood and what you can prove. For others, documentary evidence matters. And in other groups, you know, I think there's a more relaxed decision-making process, and it's more about who raised you.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have John on the line in Southlake. Hi, John.
Hi, John. Chris. Great show today. So interesting.
Thank you. You touched
specifically on the matter of eugenics a while back, and yeah. It's occurred to me that one of the great triumphs of applied biology with both plants and animals is selective breeding to for certain characteristics, improving bloodlines, as it were, in animals. You know, humans took a terrible stab at that, I guess, back in the 30s. But
yes.
Does anyone consider genetics when they're in terms of choosing mates for human beings?
Yeah. You know, I don't think so. And I mean, we certainly, it's appropriate to keep that history in mind always. And, you know, and we are animals, you know. There are ways our genomes behave in similar ways to other animals. But I think, you know, I think the mysterious and complicated ways in which we choose partners are probably far more ancient and instilled in us and less, you know, less prone to intervention from science. You know, I don't know what the answer to that question is. I don't really know why we choose people. It seems to be a very unconscious process. So I'm guessing that those processes will win out, even if there are, you know, this is, of course, within reason. You know, people have social divisions and then they make decisions within, you know, their social class or their social group. But I think and I hope as we go on that those boundaries are breaking down a bit.
Your book also made me think a lot about the similarities and differences among sibling groups. My sisters and I thought we were completely different as children, and now we look at each other and realize how very much alike we are.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, siblings are mysterious and fascinating. I have three sisters, And we look very, very alike, but we are, in fact, very different as well. So, you know, you typically share about 50% of your genome with your siblings, but that, you know, what you share and what you don't share doesn't necessarily follow any rhyme or reason. So I think the sibling relationship is just a really special and unique one, because these are people, if you look at, you know, I've looked at my chromosomes or a representation of them side by side with my sister's, and I can see visually just how much we share that is exactly the same. These operating instructions for our bodies and our brains are similar, but then there are big chunks that are different as well. So, you know, you get to feel close, but I think very different at the same time.
Do you have children yourself?
I do. I have two boys.
Have you given a lot of conscious thought to the things that you want to do, that you want to pass on, that were given to you as bits of wisdom or rules in your family of origin? Because I think we also all have things that we, no matter how much we love our parents, say to ourselves we're going to do differently.
Yes, of course. Absolutely. I'm excited for my boys because I think this moment in time when we're really becoming acquainted with our genomes is extraordinary. And you know, the cost for our generation right now is that there is a little less certainty in this domain. But I think when my boys are older, they will think about genomics the way we think about just addition and subtraction. Hmm. They will get it. It will matter to them. On top of that, you know, I'm surprised to find the number of things I thought I would never willingly pass on to them, I actually choose to do so. My dad was a pretty straightforward disciplinarian, and you know, and I realize the older I get, it's actually quite a valuable quality, especially I guess when you have five children.
Yeah.
As he did, not me.
Yeah, in our house, it's bedtimes. Early bedtimes turn out to be a great idea when you're a parent, even if you railed against them as a child.
That's right.
You know, I think I was also thinking, you know, you've written a book here and you're a journalist. We all have this biological imperative to, you know, propagate our own genes and keep the lines going. And so many of us want to leave behind cultural artifacts as well.
Yes, we do. And when you start really looking back into the past, you see how some things do last, but how most things don't. I think it may be the case. I think I might be just even a little less materialistic for having researched this book, because you realize how off the moment everything is. But what does last, of course, is DNA, and you don't have to, you know, make an effort to pass that on. If you're going to have children, it's just going to happen. So, you know, I think you see yourself perhaps more as a part of this flowing river of history, not some point where, you know, where everything is certain.
Do you feel connected in a more profound way to the great-great-grandchildren that you will never meet?
I'm very curious about them. I wish I could meet them. I think it's so fascinating. Maybe there will be technology. Maybe I will get a chance to meet them. I don't know. But I love the idea of just our genes being shuffled and shuffled again and just wondering what will last and what will disappear forever.
The new book by Christine Keneally is called The Invisible History of the Human Race, How DNA and History Shape Our Identities and Our Futures. Chris, it's been a fascinating conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Thank you, Chris. It was great to talk to you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.